We, the undersigned, pledge ourselves, our persons and bodies, to the spirit of racial reconciliation. We pledge ourselves to work intentionally right here in Alton during the decade of reconciliation beginning on this day. This pledge, the full text of which I read a few minutes ago, was signed by many of the nearly 100 people who gathered on the evening of Friday, April 4th at Trinity Lutheran Church in Alton for a service to honor the 40th anniversary of the death of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. The Reverend Kleber M. Van Zandt V, minister of this church, was one of the signers. According to a newspaper account of the event, one of the preachers spoke about the possibility of a new Alton where people worked with one another instead of against. He called for the separate tribes to integrate and not stand in the way of the progress of others. One of the central tenets of Unitarian Universalism is what we now call anti-racism, anti-discrimination, and multiculturalism. These are certainly not new values for our movement, but they are a way of focusing on the changes we need to make in ourselves and in society as we take action on our core commitments to the inherent worth and dignity of every person, to justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and to the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. We see persistent signs everywhere around us that institutional racism, discrimination, and cultural barriers are alive and well in our nation and in our world. There are consistent patterns of inequality between Americans of Northern European descent and people of other racial and ethnic groups, including those of African, Latin American, and Native American heritage. According to Department of Justice figures, 1 in 3 African American males born today will serve time in jail. Average earnings for women still trail those of men by over 25%. Transgendered individuals in America face unemployment rates of up to 80%. Gay and lesbian couples in most states are still denied basic human and legal rights in family formation. Racial and ethnic profiling are still prevalent practices among law enforcement officials. I could go on. I won't. These patterns of inequality do not need to be held in place by our individual actions, since they're deeply rooted in our social, economic, educational, and cultural systems. These are systems that take generations to change, even once that change begins. So I'm led to ask, how can that change begin? And the only answer I have for myself is that it must begin with me. As Mahatma Gandhi famously said, we must be the change we wish to see in the world. Over the past several years, as I've studied the deep roots of racism and discrimination in the United States, I kept coming across this notion of privilege. I struggled to understand what that meant, why it seemed so elusive to me, and yet is so persistent and so resistant to change. One way of defining privilege is that it is a social advantage that you did not earn, that you did not do anything to merit, but were simply born with. One of my colleagues once described it as, it is as though I wake up every morning and someone has put $10 in my pocket. So I start the day $10 ahead of anyone else who doesn't have my position of privilege. I've been in sessions, I've been in workshops where I watched a video about the ways that two men of the same education, wearing the same clothes, driving the same car, with the only difference being the color of their skin, got completely different treatment when they tried to rent an apartment, get a car loan, or even browse the selections in a record store. I finally got to the point where I was able to acknowledge that I'm part of a privileged class in the United States, even though I don't feel particularly privileged. I have fair skin, I have light-colored eyes and hair, I was born to educated parents with a good income, I was well-fed and played safely in the fresh air, I was not abused or neglected in any way. I had access to an excellent public education, did not graduate from college burdened with loans. I've never suffered an extended period of forced unemployment. And no one challenges me when I want to rent an apartment or get a loan for a house or for a car, and no one follows me down the aisle of a store to make sure I don't steal anything. At least, I've never noticed anyone following me. Sure, I'm a hard worker, and I earn my own way, but I do have advantages in society that I in no way sought or earned. So why don't I feel particularly privileged? I just feel normal. And then it hit me. Normal. That's a good indicator of being in a position of privilege, that the good life feels normal. And one wonders about all those abnormal people down there living lives of struggle, discrimination, and failure. What's that all about? What's wrong with them that they don't just work hard and succeed like I have? Why are they not normal like I am? And then one day, as I was pondering this problem, I got an image. I think many times in metaphors and images. I find it helps me understand things. And in my position of privilege, I saw myself standing kind of at the top of a system, standing on a mirror and surrounded by mirrors. And all those mirrors simply reflected myself back to me, no matter which direction I looked. No matter who or what I thought I was looking at, what I was really seeing was my own status, my own norming. And everybody I was looking at through the mirrors was distorted by the reflection of my own experience and my own expectations. And as long as I didn't realize how those mirrors were shaping my perceptions, I really couldn't clearly see the experience or the reality of anyone else. As long as I looked through a reflection shaped by my own reality, by my own norms, I was unconsciously assessing others according to my own privileged status, and often finding them falling short, because they were clearly not me. They weren't the norm. In the book To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee's classic novel about the complexities of human society, young Jem Finch, the son of Atticus Finch, the lawyer, claims to have figured out the web of relationships in their southern town. There's four kinds of folks in the world, says Jem. There's the ordinary kind, like us and the neighbors. There's the kind like the Cunninghams out in the woods, the kind like the Ewells down at the dump, and the Negroes. Our folks don't like the Cunninghams don't like the Ewells, and the Ewells hate and despise the colored folks. Jem's language, the ordinary kind of folks like us, our kind of folks, that's that norming, that mirrored reflection, which norms everything around our own identity that I'm talking about. I'm normal, people like me are normal, people not like me are therefore not normal. They easily become the alien other, different and somehow deficient, lesser than I. My mirrors can distort my perceptions of the reality of other people, and when that happens, I'm not able to experience them in their own full and unique dignity and humanity. I judge them through my reflection, and they come up wanting. We see those mirrors represented in everyday speech, and they're certainly emerging in the current presidential race, and in this case, I'm talking about the national president, not the UUA president. Supporters of Hillary Clinton complain of the language on radio talk shows, male radio talk shows, disparaging women as unfit for political leadership simply because they're not men. Significant numbers of the US population, hearing a name with a sound unfamiliar to them, still believe that Barack Obama practices the Muslim faith, even after the very public controversy over his Christian minister. And an opinion editorial in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch a couple of weeks ago defended a young West Virginian voter who felt that John McCain was more of a full-blooded American than Barack Obama. He explained, his feelings aren't racist. He would just be more comfortable with someone who's a full-blooded American as president. Someone who's his sort of American, who is the person he sees in the mirror. Glenn Lurie, who's a scholar of race relations from Brown University, explains the concept of racial stigma this way. If we believe that people of a different look and hue and shape of face and such are different from us, and we act on that belief, we can create dynamics that make that a fact. Moreover, if we're unaware of how some of these influences bias and influence our conceptions in society, then we can draw conclusions and be very comfortable and set in those conclusions without interrogating them. The differences distorted by our mirrors are not restricted to race and ethnicity. They extend to gender, age, sexual identity, physical or mental ability, and other defining human characteristics. Writer Rita Nakashima Brock, in the book Proverbs of Ashes, describes her discovery of her own distorted assumptions about others. She says, "I was no homophobic, but I was heterosexist. I fell easily into assumptions that someone was heterosexual unless they made a point of coming out to me. I was oblivious to heterosexual privilege, the ease of fitting in, of having my relationships be open and public, of having my sexual identity an unquestioned norm that required no examination. Seeing that privilege myself helped me understand the difficulty that white men had perceiving and acknowledging their own privilege in society." Brock goes on to underscore the importance of paying attention to those issues that diminish our shared humanity. She says, "Racism, sexism, intimate violence, and homophobia are abuses of power that are devastating to love. They prevent us from being fully present and alive. They diminish the presence of spirit by wrapping oppressor and oppressed, perpetrator and victim, together in emotional chains that force the air out of the spaces between them." I think this distortion in perspective is a common, even perhaps a universal, characteristic of human societies. Young boys and girls notice and judge not only anatomical, but social differences. So a brother tells his sister, "Don't act like a girl or you can't play with the boys who are playing more interesting games." If they don't figure it out on their own, children are too often taught that people with different skin color and eye shape, physical differences or a different family structure are not our kind. They're not the people we associate with unless we want to risk being banished from our own group. So if we care about human harmony, if we want to move beyond a damaging tribalism that diminishes the presence of spirit in human life, what can we do? I think a first step is awareness, becoming aware of the mirrors in our lives, to acknowledge that we each tend to live with and judge others, oblivious to the reflective and distorting surfaces of the mirrors that surround us, to those normative assumptions that we make, and to recognize that we may not be seeing and hearing others clearly, because very early in life we develop that unconscious system of judgment that places a subtle barrier between us and anyone not like us. I'm not talking about active prejudice, for we may be loving, I hope we all are, loving and tolerant and wanting to build bridges. But we can still have in place that invisible barrier that reflects and distorts our perception of reality and that immobilizes us and makes us feel helpless within an oppressive system. I recently mediated a conflict between a university professor who was of Hispanic background and three graduate students from the Middle East. And these students had been accused of plagiarism by the professor. Those on both sides of the dispute were simply baffled by what had happened. And as I made my way through the controversy, I suddenly realized that what I was seeing was another experience of those reflective mirrors. The professor had carefully explained his expectations to the students, and he asked them whether they understood. And they nodded dutifully, because they had been taught always to say yes in the presence of authority. And they hadn't really comprehended a word of what he had said. In the series of events that followed, the professor felt manipulated and disrespected, the students felt persecuted, and I suddenly realized that they simply weren't hearing each other, and I was seeing the mirrors at work. On each side of the barrier, they were communicating in their own languages and cultural constraints, never realizing that their words and gestures were simply bouncing back at them, and that their mirrors of cultural norms and expectations were invisible and were creating a barrier that actually got them in a lot of trouble. Understanding across difference begins with an awareness of ourselves and of the ways we encounter and understand others. Only when we begin to engage with the notion that our view of the world is shaped by our normative expectations, what I'm calling our mirrors, can we become aware of those mirrors, aware of that unconscious system of judgment, and begin to scratch off that reflective surface. We have years of practice in being blinded by our cultural and social norms, so it won't happen all at once, but it's vital that we begin, because we are that gentle, angry people. We begin by deciding that if we wish the world to change, we must first gather up the courage to acknowledge the subtle role that each of us plays in upholding the cultural and social systems of injustice. Take a deep breath and resolve anew each day to be the change we wish to see in the world. Then, one scratch at a time, with love and patience for ourselves and others, we can start to remove the silver backing from our own mirrors, reducing the distortion, improving the clarity of our perceptions and our understanding. We do this by noticing our responses, our assumptions, our judgments, and by asking again and again, am I acting out of tribalism, or am I acting out of clear understanding and an intention toward justice? Am I seeing the person before me in their true humanity, even if she or he has a different skin tone, a different shape of eye, facial bones, a different gender or age or sexual identity than I do? Am I clearly hearing what he is saying? Am I interpreting her actions accurately? It will not happen all at once, but I believe that if we can begin to move toward clearer perceiving and understanding, then I believe that we can take the next steps to dissolve the barriers, to connect across our differences, to grasp hands to move toward a world of greater justice and harmony. And then we can, as the Alton Declaration affirms, build up mutual understanding and affection among the peoples of different races in our community, so that at the end of the next 10 years, we may find Alton blessed not only with inward grace, but also with the outward signs of the beloved community. May it be so, and amen.